Mr. Bezetny.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Kevin Bezetny, and this morning I'm here on behalf of my fellow attorney, James Gordon Banks. As the Court is aware that the issues before the Court today stem from the August 6, 2007 order entered by the District Court entering a Rule 11 sanction against Mr. Banks in the amount of nearly $80,000. The exact amount was $79,302.18 for his role as an attorney in the Shales versus General Chauffeurs litigation.
If nothing else, doesn't Mr. Banks have prospective income that would enable him to pay a sanctions award? Didn't he acknowledge a number of expected fees when he was examined during the citation proceedings?
He did, Your Honor. He did identify all of the cases in which he has any interest or might have any interest. But as Mr. Banks pointed out in his citation and as we pointed out to the Court, those are all contingency cases. It's not certain that there is going to be any recovery. And even if there is going to be recovery, it's going to take time, it's going to take money, it's going to take income.
Well, this might suggest that the prevailing parties will have some trouble recovering from Banks. I don't see why it entitles Banks to be off the hook. We've said on a number of occasions that these awards of fees for litigation misconduct are essentially tort judgments. They're judgments for a wrong inflicted on somebody else. And I thought if there was one thing clear about tort judgments, they're based on the loss to the victim rather than the wealth of the wrongdoer. Why should this be any different?
Well, the cases are very clear that the Court does have an obligation to consider the wherewithal of, in this case, Mr. Banks, in deciding whether or not to enter a Rule 11 sanction. And as we pointed out to the District Court, Mr. Banks does not have substantial assets. He doesn't have any assets. He submitted an affidavit, an unrebutted affidavit to the District Court, which is a central part of the argument before the Court today, that Mr. Banks has essentially a small $2,000 IRA, a wedding ring, a watch, no interest in any real estate, no interest in any cars, nothing.
What about the $100,000 that passed through the check, his checking account between 2006 and 2007? How does that square with any notion that he doesn't have resources?
Well, all of those, as we pointed out, all of the money that came in went back into the firm in order to keep the additional and other cases going. There was money that was earned by Mr. Banks at an earlier point in time. It wasn't substantial. He was working very hard, very young attorney, working essentially as a sole practitioner. There was some income came in that was disclosed in the tax returns and all the other documents, but the money essentially went back into the firm and to pay minimal expenses. There wasn't any grand amount of money. There wasn't any savings accounts. There wasn't any stocks, bonds, or other holdings. So at the point in time that the District Court had this information before it, they were well aware of Mr. Banks' financial wherewithal, as were the defendants.
Well, Mr. Banks, one of the other arguments you make is that he can't pay anything because all of his assets, like the home and the cars, are in his wife's name. I guess under your theory, couldn't any attorney avoid monetary sanctions by transferring all of his assets to a family member and then claim to be poor or unable to pay the sanction?
Well, I think if that were the circumstance, we'd have a whole host of other issues here, Your Honor, including fraudulent conveyance and such. But that's not the case here. The arrangements that were made between Mrs. Banks, this is being her second marriage, and Mr. Banks at the time they got married, had absolutely nothing to do with this. This was done years and years before this situation arose. It was not done in anticipation of this situation. It was not done during this situation. It was something done as a matter of preference for Mrs. Banks at the time that she married Mr. Banks. I would agree with you. If this was a circumstance where there was a shifting of assets, there was a hiding of assets, a transferring of assets between friends, family members, strangers, that would raise a whole host of issues, but that's not the case here. It never been, and there's been no suggestion by the defendants or any of the courts that there ever was. This was a situation, as we put forth, where Mr. Banks, having been a relatively young attorney, newly practicing, only practicing for about 4 years at the point in time that this Shales litigation was filed.
I'm still puzzled by the contention that this should matter. Suppose a young physician, 4 years out of medical school, commits malpractice and injures a patient. Will the damages in that case depend in any way on the fact that the physician is not yet well-to-do? The answer is no. It will depend on the injury caused. Why should the award here not depend on the injury caused?
Well, Your Honor, here, under Rule 11, the cases say that the court has an obligation to consider.
I'm asking why. Why should the award not depend on the injury caused?
Because Rule 11, the purpose of Rule 11 is to focus upon the attorney's conduct and to prohibit such conduct in the future. And the cases are clear that the court should find the least severe type of sanction.
The only answer you can give, as I hear it, is, quote, the cases are clear, but you can't tell me why.
Well,
this is a major shortcoming, I think.
Your Honor, with all due respect, it's because that Rule 11 said...
All due respect means, if you weren't a judge, I'd be calling you an idiot. It's not a good phrase.
I apologize, Your Honor. Rule 11 indicates that it is...
By the way, the award here is also based on 1927.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you might tell us why a 1927 award.
The logic is the same, Your Honor. The court had the discretion to consider these factors. The district court obviously thought that this was an issue. As the court is well aware, at the point in time that Mr. Banks' affidavit was initially filed in April and May of 2007, the district court, sua sponte, on its own, offered the defendants the opportunity, a very unusual opportunity, to take Mr. Banks' citation deposition, which he submitted to, well before any type of sanction or award or judgment was entered against him. So the court was certainly aware that his financial wherewithal, his ability to satisfy any type of award or judgment, was a factor that it should take into consideration and afforded the defendants that opportunity. And as we know from the citation deposition, completely supported Mr. Banks' affidavit, that he did not have assets other than what were disclosed. He provided his tax returns. He provided the evidence of what items he owned. There was never any counter affidavit. There was never any counter evidence presented by the defendants to the district court. The district court had only before evidence of Mr. Banks' inability to satisfy any type of monetary judgment. And in light of the fact that Rule 11 makes clear that the district court should, if it is going to impose a Rule 11 sanction, should choose the least severe type of sanction, we suggested to the district court that least severe of sanction in this instance should have been sent some type of admission, some type of non-monetary sanction, or if the court was going to issue a monetary sanction, substantially less than the nearly $80,000 that it issued its award in this case. Because effectively, what that award did is theoretically bankrupted Mr. Banks and forced him to shut down his practice, which he's done. And clearly, that is not the purpose of Rule 11. That's not the intent of Rule 11. It was never intended to do that. It was intended to point out conduct that needed to be corrected so that it doesn't happen again with that attorney and for other attorneys. In this case, the district court went above and beyond that. It had all this information with regard to Mr. Banks' wherewithal at its disposal. It didn't have any counter affidavits. It didn't have any counter documentation, any evidence whatsoever. The fact of the matter is the court, with all due respect to the district court, abused its discretion when it issued that award of nearly $80,000. There was no basis for it. This issue, this matter, could have been resolved in much less, much harsh terms. It effectively destroyed Mr. Banks' ability to practice law, and going forward, he won't be practicing law. That's not what Rule 11 was intended to do. It was not intended to destroy a person's ability to practice law. It was intended to point out their conduct, their failings, their shortcomings, and to address those issues so that that type of conduct doesn't happen again. Well, it can't happen again for Mr. Banks because he's not going to be practicing law. And that, we submit, was an abuse of discretion by the district court and ought to have been reversed. And with regard to the motions for reconsideration, we pointed out to the court that the court did, in fact, have ample evidence before it of Mr. Banks' financial standing and his ability or lack or inability, his lack of ability to satisfy any type of monetary judgment or sanction entered against him. Certainly any substantial amount, but nonetheless the court felt as though that this was the appropriate amount, $79,302. And that, Your Honors, we contend was an abuse of discretion. It's not supported by the record. There could have been and should have respectfully been other means for the court to convey its message to Mr. Banks about his conduct that are allowed under Rule 11 that did not require such a harsh, severe sanction that effectively put the man out of business. Unless the court has any other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Provenzal.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Counsel.
Mr. Provenzal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did the evidence that was produced in the citation proceeding suggest in any way that Mr. Banks was shedding assets in anticipation of the sanctions award?
Circumstantially, Your Honor, I believe it did. We presented evidence to the district court of the bank records of Mr. Banks and the transactions that he engaged in from the time that he was served with the notice of the motion for sanctions or the petition for sanctions and the time that he ultimately filed his response to the petition for fees where he made the allegation in the motion that he had an inability to pay. We also raised in connection after that point in our reply to the petition for sanctions that Mr. Banks had in other ways made misrepresentations under oath that called his veracity into question that I respectfully suggest the district court took in the context of the entirety of Mr. Banks' conduct throughout the case that more than supported the inference circumstantially that he had taken efforts to shift assets from the view of the local union as a creditor were sanctions to be awarded. Specifically, I think, and most profound in proving that circumstantially is the amount of money that passed through his checking account in that one-year period in excess of $100,000. And I would point to the court
And give us the timing of that
one year
as it relates to the proceeding.
We filed our petition for sanctions in April of 2006. At that time, Mr. Banks had in excess of $25,000 in cash on hand in his checking account and savings account. From that period of time up until April or May of 2007 in that time frame, he filed his response to the petition for sanctions on, I believe it was April 30th or April 29th, it was immediately around that time that his checking account had depleted to about $1,700, and there was no balance in his savings account. Effectively, the records further prove, aside from the depletion of that cash, the $25,000, the records further demonstrate, and contrary to Mr. Bezetsny's comment about what he was spending it on, I think the comment he had made was that he was putting the money back into his practice. The records demonstrate that Mr. Banks spent that money on things like watches, Brooks Brothers clothes, boating vacations. A substantial portion of those records was spent on luxuries and sundries that are all borne out by those bank records. And respectfully to Mr. Bezetsny's characterization, I think none of it is reasonably characterized as law firm expenses.
And these were all expenses, expenditures after this April 25th date.
Exactly, Judge.
$100,000.
Correct. And so the evidence of record that the district court had before it at the time that the district court made its assessment of the sufficiency of Mr. Banks' claim of inability to pay was not only that evidence which circumstantially supported efforts on his part to divest himself of assets that could satisfy a judgment, but also further evidence that undermined his credibility in claiming in any event that he had an inability to pay. Specifically, we had, through subpoena, obtained various records that were public records. that were filed by Mr. Banks and his wife jointly in 2003 and 2005 to the federal government as tax returns. And each of those he claimed personally in his Schedule C or in his 8829 expense accounting for a deduction for depreciation in an asset, ownership in his home as a basis in which he could then claim a deduction from his income from practicing law. In that sworn filing with the federal court or with the federal government, he represented that he did own his home with his wife, which was a basis for him to seek a deduction from his law firm income. And the tax rules, I think, are very clear. You cannot claim a deduction for something you do not own. In the instant proceeding for the petition for sanctions, Mr. Banks claims that he doesn't own his own home. And given that it's Mr. Banks' burden to prove an inability to pay, the petitioners in the fees petition did not proceed to seek any further any evidence to prove that he did own his home. It was merely our position with the district court that it is sufficient for us to call into question his veracity in claiming under oath that he did not own his own home or vehicles, or that he was otherwise destitute by raising the bank records, in order to undermine his claim in the sufficiency of it, factually, that he failed to own any assets, demonstrating that he had an inability to pay any judgment of fees in the sanctions proceeding. One issue that we did not address initially with the court in the early jurisdictional questions that the court had raised about the appeal outright is the issue of subject matter jurisdiction of this court, which the petitioners strongly urge this court to find that was lacking in this case, as Mr. Banks did not timely file his appeal. The record before the court in this case is that Mr. Banks had filed his Rule 59E motion, which he titled a motion to reconsider, alter, and or amend the judgment.
Most Rule 59 and 60 motions are meritless, and often they rehash arguments that were, had been previously made. Is it really your view that we should treat such motions as nullities that fail to toll the time for appeal?
No, not at all. And I think Rule 4 is very explicit that a Rule 59E motion, that is a proper Rule 59E motion, tolls the time to appeal. Our position is that the motion that was filed by Mr. Banks on August 20th, which certainly was within the time frame for filing such a motion, and the district court properly considered as a Rule 59E motion, was not a Rule 59E motion, but rather was simply a motion to reconsider a finding of fact that the court had made predicate to the court's ultimate entry of the judgment.
But the district court treated that as a 59E, as a Rule 59E motion.
I agree, Your Honor. The district court did treat it as that, only to the extent that it was filed within the time frame for filing a Rule 59E motion. The motion was a joint 59E and 60 motion, and the court noted in its minute order, given that it was time that it was filed within the time for filing such motions, the court is going to consider it as a Rule 59E motion. But specific to what was argued in that motion is not the character of what a Rule 59E motion is. And without getting into arguments of ontology of the being of a motion, the specific of this particular motion is that it is not that character. And specifically, if the court looks at what the relief was that was sought in that motion, it was relief that the court change its mind about a finding of fact that the court had made predicate to the ultimate judgment. The Western Transportation case that I had cited to the court, which is the authority for courts to, and that this court had found, was authority to disregard what is titled as a Rule 59E motion as acting as such for tolling purposes of the time to appeal, what is specifically on point in this case. In that Western Transportation case, this court looked at the motion filed by the appellant in that case in front of the district court and noted that the motion that was filed did not address any issue other than a factual finding that the district court had made predicate to its ultimate judgment on the case.
Well, that's that district court. This is this district court.
Yes. And the point, Judge, that I'm making, of course, is the similarity of the issues in the Western Transportation case and this case in terms of the character of the motion that was titled a Rule 59e motion that, in its essence, was not. And so for the authority made out in the Western Transportation case, we respectfully submit is directly controlling in this case as to the character that the respondent's Rule 59e motion should take in this case, and that it did not serve to toll the appeal.
Judges don't have enough work. Basically, if we follow your recommendation, you know, district judges will not only have to look at the title of the motion, they'll have to examine the basis of the motion, determine whether it has some merit or not, and then determine whether the number that's of the filing of 59E is accurate. I mean, just from a policy standpoint, you're putting a lot of extra work on the district court. If its title is a 59E, the court should be able to accept that, and then you can attack it if it's a bogus motion, if it has no merit. I mean, that's the reason we have the rules set up the way we do.
And certainly that is correct, Your Honor. The point, I think, to be made in terms of the workload for the district court is that I don't think it's anything more than the district court already bears in assessing the merits of Rule 59E motions in terms of the particularity that the motions have to set out.
Right. So why not let the court just do it in that context and just rule on it, period? Deny the motion 59E if it's meritless, it has no. That's just one of the arguments you throw in the kitchen sink to the district court.
Well, I think in terms of the merit of the argument, it's not so much to the burden on the district court, but more to the burden on the appellate courts to take appeals that are not timely filed, and the burden on parties who are opposing appeals to have the opportunity to respond to those within the time frame that is reasonable under the circumstances.
So it's us you're worrying about.
I apologize, Your Honor, I didn't.
It's us you're worrying about.
Well, I'm not worrying about the court. I respectfully submit, Judge, that I'm interpreting the case law, and I think in a reasonable manner that suggests that if there are policy concerns to be weighed here, that they can be weighed in both ways. Ultimately, Your Honors, setting aside the issue of the subject matter jurisdiction, the merits of the defendant's appeal or of the respondent's appeal are severely lacking. Not only has the court, did the district court have the record of Mr. Banks' circumstantial evidence of him moving his assets around to demonstrate that he was judgment-proof, the district court also had evidence of not just prospective but actual income that he was that was a receivable on his books already, that he was ready to take as a receivable because the case had already, there were two cases
that
had already settled. It was $25,000.
$80,000.
That is correct, Your Honor. However, he testified as to numerous other cases that were in a posture to settle that had not settled simply because of the timing. Now, whether the timing of those cases not settling because it was Mr. Banks' intention to put those off until some such later time as he had the opportunity to avoid the judgment in this case, or whether it was simply because that's the timing of cases and dealing with insurance companies or opposing parties, I don't think the issue for this court to assess whether it was an abuse of discretion of the district court to not take that into consideration in making its assessment of Mr. Banks' failure to substantiate his claim that he had an inability to pay. It is enough that there were questions surrounding his claim raised on all of these fronts that were more than enough to substantiate the district court's finding that Mr. Banks had not carried his burden to establish that he had an inability to pay. One last comment that I would make to this court. Mr. Banks' attorney has represented that Mr. Banks is out of practice right now and that he's taken himself out of practice. That is not a matter of fact before this court. It is not in the record and is not otherwise, I think, appropriate to consider. It is not the first bit of fact that Mr. Banks has submitted to this court that should not properly be before this court. I would note to the court that Mr. Banks has identified this claim of his wife that was filed on August 13th, 7 days after the district court had ruled and made its finding as to whether or not Mr. Banks had an inability to pay. At no time did Mr. Banks ever, or his attorney ever, characterize that additional evidence as newly discovered evidence, and certainly it could not have been and should never have been submitted as an end around to the normal rules of Rule 59 and 60 that if newly discovered evidence is to be submitted, that it is to meet the character of newly discovered evidence, meaning that it was not available to be known to the party at the time through reasonable diligence or otherwise within his opportunity to know. Neither of which could be satisfied in this case, given the fact that it was his wife and it was his assets, all of which he had testified to throughout the course of his citation proceeding. But more to the point of where he's at right now, if his claim is that he's out of practice, I respectfully submit to the court, if he's out of practice, it's because in the circumstances of this case, he's put himself in that position today, so he can make that argument to this court today. And I suggest to the court that if there is any weight to be put on it, it is mere coincidence, given the alternate circumstances that Mr. Banks is currently under prosecution by the ARDC, and that if he has wound down his law practice, he's done so as part of some plea agreement with the ARDC so that he doesn't receive as serious a sanction otherwise. If we are going to be arguing facts that are not of record, I respectfully submit those to the court as alternate explanations.
The ARDC website, at least as of today, describes him as in good standing and the disciplinary proceeding as still open.
That is correct.
Websites does not suggest that it's been resolved.
It hasn't been. But again, Your Honor, I think that actions taken by Mr. Banks that have been submitted to this court in support of his position that he's put himself out of business and that the harsh sanction that the district court has imposed on him has driven him in that direction is a disingenuous argument considering the fact that any actions he takes between now and when the ultimate disposition on his ARDC complaint is resolved are actions that he can point to in his ARDC proceeding as mitigation to reduce the severity of the sanction that's imposed on him by the Illinois Supreme Court. For those reasons that we've cited in our brief, Your Honors, and for the record that was presented before the district court, it is our firm view that the district court did not abuse its discretion in entering the award of sanctions, both on its finding that the respondent attorney didn't not.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
Anything further?
Very briefly, I think that it's very clear that this court does properly have jurisdiction over this matter. That was a proper Rule 59e motion. The district court found it was a proper 59e motion. The notice of appeal was finally timely filed. Jurisdiction is not an issue before this court. With regard to counsel's argument that there was circumstantial evidence of movement and asset hiding and shifting, that's just ridiculous. All of the evidence of Mr. Banks' assets were before the district court. The district court found absolutely no evidence, no suggestion that he was shifting assets, hiding things, anything whatsoever. Counsel has made the point that there were several tax returns that were prepared by an outside tax preparer or by Mrs. Banks, who has that experience, that indicated one year that Mr. Banks had was listed as an owner on the home, and then other years he was not. I point out that there was 2 years in question where he was, and other years, the majority of the years, where he was not. Also want to point out to the court that Mrs. Banks submitted through personal counsel a document to the district court in conjunction with the fact that during this proceeding, the defendants were seeking to recover Mr. Banks' assets and discover his assets and discover her citations, because what they learned through the citation to discover assets is exactly what Mr. Banks said. He didn't have any substantial assets. He didn't have any meaningful assets. And they were looking to Mrs. Banks as a source of potential source for satisfaction of any judgment in anticipation of when it was entered. Because if you recall, the citation to discover assets was what took place in June, sua sponte by the district court. The sanction, the Rule 11 issue, did not come to pass until August 6th. So all of this discovery, all of this citation proceeding, all these traditionally post-judgment remedy proceedings took place before the sanction had been entered. And Mrs. Banks submitted through her personal counsel evidence of the fact that through the affidavit of a CPA that there was nothing wrong with Mr. Banks taking the home office exemption even though he didn't have an ownership interest in the home. And again, that statement, that affidavit, that information, all before the district court, unrebutted by the defendants. Unless the court has any further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.